Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, activists in more than 20 countries participated in a day of action called the Global Frackdown. It was the second annual event of its kind. Their mission statement says, quote, "We are communities fighting fracking, frack sand mining, pipelines, compressor stations, exports of natural gas, coal bed methane, and more. Fracking is not part of our vision for a clean energy future and should be banned," end quote. So on today's Your Call, we are looking at the global movement against fracking. Where is it growing? Where has pushback been successful? They have many success stories. And what can we learn from these movements? Here in California this morning, 20 leading climate scientists delivered a letter to Governor Jerry Brown calling on him to impose a moratorium on fracking in California. A recent study in the Journal of Geophysical Research found that the methane leak rate from Los Angeles area oil and gas operations was 17%. Because methane is a powerful greenhouse pollutant, leakage rates of more than 3% make these fuels worse for the climate than coal. At least 1,200 California oil and gas wells have been fracked in the past 3 years without a scientific review. Senate Bill 4, which was recently signed into law by Governor Brown, would allow fracking to continue without safeguards for air, water, or the climate. Joining us to talk about these issues is Josh Fox, director and producer of Gasland and Gasland Part 2. These documentaries expose the health and environmental impacts of hydraulic fracturing. And Josh joins us from New York. Hi, Josh. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Geert de Kock. He's a policy officer for Food and Water Watch Europe. Geert works on the campaign to ban fracking in Europe. He holds a PhD in political science from the University of Alberta. During his time there, Geert became involved in grassroots environmental groups, having witnessed firsthand the disastrous environmental impacts of the Alberta tar sands. And Geert joins us from Belgium. Hi, Geert. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, nice to have you. And we're joined by Maria Olteanu. She's an anti-fracking activist in Romania. She says she was recently living a peaceful life as a jewelry maker, but when fracking hit Romania, she saw the film Gasland and now believes that fracking is the worst threat we face. She's now working to ban fracking full time. Hi, Maria. Thank you for joining us.
Hi.
Hi, nice to have you. So, Josh, I want to start off with you because you have traveled around the globe with your film Gasland and Gasland 2. I mean, it's hard enough to keep up with what's happening in California. What are you seeing around the globe? Is fracking really exploding in other countries?
Well, you have a movement that's certainly exploding around the world. I started working on fracking in 2008, when the natural gas industry knocked on my door in the Upper Delaware River Basin, that's part of the watershed for New York City, for Philadelphia, and for parts of southern New Jersey. And, you know, millions of people all around the world were getting that very same approach, whether you were in Pennsylvania or New York or California, Colorado, Wyoming, or in France or in the Netherlands or in Romania or in Australia. And what we're really seeing here is a shift in the energy paradigm coming from the fossil fuel industry away from conventional sources of fossil fuels, the easily obtainable oil, coal, and gas, to unconventional fossil fuels. That's fracked gas, fracked oil, tar sands oil, deep water drilling off the continental shelf for oil, mountaintop removal for coal. And what these techniques do is they invade territories where people live in huge amounts of area. In America alone, the oil and gas industry has leased more land than the total land mass of California and Florida combined. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing is a similar pattern across the globe. And this means just to perpetuate using fossil fuels, the fossil fuel industry is moving into places, huge amounts of areas, and now we know of about 30 countries where they're proposing to frack for natural gas. When they frack, and for oil, it takes up an enormous amount of area. They have to do a scale, which is thousands and thousands of wells. And when you're faced with exploitive, extractive industry, that has a history, a long history of human rights violations across the world, and, of course, what we know now about water contamination, air pollution, health crisis, and as you mentioned so importantly, the climate risk from developing unconventional fossil fuels, people start to rebel and revolt and protest and organize. And it's something I've witnessed, like I said, in Australia and Europe and the United States. With the last film, we toured to 45 cities. We were in 26 states and 13 countries. It's just been amazing to watch this take off and for people to bind together to take back their democratic right to self-determination.
Talk a little bit about the movements that you're seeing around the globe, because there's a very long list of success stories.
Yeah. Well, when we were in Brussels, we opened Gasland Part 2 in the European Parliament. It was our premiere. I met activists from Poland who were doing blockades of Chevron that had been going on at that point 100 days. I met Maria from Romania, where people have organized similar types of blockades and protests and have kept out Chevron. I met activists from the UK in Balcombe who were doing a blockade, in Sussex who were trying to keep out Quadrilla, which is the UK gas drilling company. And in France, we met winemakers in the central region who had 20,000 people marching in the streets, and they managed to get a total ban on fracking in France. In the Netherlands, they just passed a moratorium. So what you're seeing is traditional techniques, but a little bit more insistent, where you're actually having to stand in the way of this equipment. And that kind of thing is happening also all across the United States. In California, we launched with Food and Water Watch and Credo and Move On and a number of other groups, Californians Against Fracking in May, which started with 100,000 signatures on a petition to Governor Brown to ban fracking. It's really unbelievable. And you know, I think it's a result of the fact that people are cornered in their own homes, in their backyards, with this incredibly invasive transformation of their character and integrity, the places they live, to become industrial zones. And then also an awareness looking out at this happening all across the globe, which, of course, gives everyone inspiration and a sense of solidarity and a sense of moving together to change the world towards renewable energy instead of this paradigm of shifting to unconventional or extreme energy, shifting to renewable energy, which is what the world really needs.
And, Josh, this morning, 20 climate scientists delivered a letter to California Governor Jerry Brown calling on him to impose a moratorium on fracking in California. And one thing that I love about your new film, Gasland 2, is in the beginning, you show politicians from, you know, Democrats and Republicans who sound exactly the same when it comes to fracking. What is the major difference between what you hear and what you see from politicians in the United States and politicians in other countries?
Well, this is really a head-scratcher for me, for Governor Brown, for Governor Cuomo, for President Barack Obama, Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado, not to be jumping on the progressive bandwagon of the biggest grassroots environmental movement in decades and saying, you know what, you're right, we can't go down this road, we have to go towards renewables. This is something that the Democrats could show real leadership on. And what we're seeing in other parts of the globe, with some progressive governments, for example, President Hollande in France, has said, nope, we're going to ban fracking for my entire term in France. There's a real disconnect right now with where that grassroots movement is headed, and our government, a progressive government like Governor Brown in the United States. It's a testament to the power of the oil and gas industry and how much they've indeed corrupted the agenda here in the United States. And there are other places where they're not as strong, where you don't have that same type of influence. You know, the people actually matter more, it seems like, when they're fighting back. And I'm very, very inspired by what's happened in France, by what's happened in Romania and Bulgaria and in countries in Europe and also in Australia, where you have seen the government actually pay attention to its people. The one bright spot I would say right now is that in New York, the citizenship, with thousands of protests and hundreds of thousands of signatures, have actually gotten Governor Cuomo's ear and said, listen, you've got to not allow this to happen. And so far that's worked, although, of course, what we need right now is for Governor Cuomo to, you know, break the dam wide open and ban fracking in New York. And we would hope the same kind of thing for Governor Brown, because this is, you know, these are the progressive centers of the United States. It's unimaginable for me that these progressive governors are ignoring the citizens in the way that they are right now.
That is Josh Fox. He's director and producer of Gasland and Gasland 2. These documentaries expose the health and environmental impacts of hydraulic fracturing. And today we are talking about the global movement against fracking. It is growing. So far, they've had about 336 success stories. That's measures against fracking from the United States to Belgium, the Netherlands, the Czech Republic, Argentina, Egypt. We'll be talking about this throughout the show. And a little later in the show, we'll be joined by activists in Argentina and the UK. And let's hear from Geert de Kock. He's a policy officer for Food and Water Watch in Europe. He's joining us from Belgium. And Geert, according to a piece in the Washington Post, fracking efforts have either proven too costly or been quelled by European leaders concerned with the potential risks to water supplies. As Josh said, the practice is banned in France, though the French government has not completely ruled it out for the future. Just give us an overview of, you know, what is the state of fracking across Europe?
Well, there's definitely a great interest from the fossil fuel companies, and mainly the American fossil fuel companies, to export this technology to Europe. And they refer to low gas prices for the moment in the U.S. to really sell this to American or to European politicians. So far, I mean, obviously the companies haven't been very diplomatic in their, or not very convincing in their efforts to convince local communities to buy into this shale gas hype. So there are indeed bans in Bulgaria, where Chevron planned to frack in an area that contains one of the largest aquifers in Bulgaria that supplies like the local, you know, agricultural sector. In France, some companies wanted to, Schubach, a Texan company, wanted to start fracking in the south of France, which is the number one tourist destination in the world. Also, Spanish states, you know, local states, regions, have banned fracking. Lots of communities have declared themselves across Europe fracking free. Currently, the new right-wing, left-wing coalition talks in Germany are talking about a moratorium. There's a lot of studying going on about the environmental impacts, and a lot of European policymakers are asking, you know, the U.S. companies, like, give us the data to show fracking is safe. And so far, there's been not a lot of evidence coming our way to say, well, you know, this technology is safe, and we see a lot of evidence coming from the U.S. That it isn't safe and that the environmental impacts have been disastrous. And I mean, there's generally a confusion in Europe where how are you going to get a meaningful quantity of gas out of this if we know it takes, as Josh said, thousands of wells to be drilled. I believe 1 in 20 Americans now lives within a mile from a shale gas well. Like in Europe, almost everybody would be living within a mile of a shale gas well. And so how are you going to do this? How are you going to drill these tens of thousands of wells over a decade to supply a negligible quantity of gas? And so there's really a concern about the environmental impact, and obviously the pictures we get from the U.S. and the evidence doesn't inspire us with a lot of confidence. Having said that, there are some governments, not populations, governments that have bought into the shale gas hype. The U.K. and Poland and Romania are the prime examples where governments have really said, we must do this against all odds, regardless of the evidence, and we'll do it well somehow, somewhere, with no guarantees, no revisiting of environmental regulations, you know, just going for it. And obviously this has provoked massive resistance in those countries.
And that is Geert de Kock. He's policy officer for Food and Water Watch Europe. He's joining us from Belgium, talking about campaigns to ban fracking in Europe. Josh Fox is director and producer of Gasland and Gasland Part 2. And Josh will be with us for about 10 more minutes. So if you have any questions for Josh about fracking, he's been talking about this and traveling the globe to raise awareness about fracking for many years. And he really has his hand on the pulse of what's happening around the globe. And also all of the new reports that are coming out on on a regular basis that look at the health and environmental effects of hydraulic fracturing. Again, this involves injecting millions of gallons of water, sand, and chemicals, we don't know which chemicals, that's part of the problem, deep into the earth in order to break up shale rock and then release the gas. And you can join, oh, we have full lines actually already, but you can join us in a few minutes at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Maria Olteanu. She's an anti-fracking activist in Romania. And Maria, I love your story because I understand that just recently you were living a life as a jewelry maker. And then when fracking began, you saw Gasland. And what happened when you saw that film?
Wasn't that fracking actually began when I started to get involved into this. I knew it was going to happen. It is going to start happening quite soon. When I saw Gasland, first of all, I had a feeling of being so small, so useless. I can't do anything. That put in place such a horrible crime against humankind. Then, actually, a few days after, I really felt empowered. I really felt that that's my call. I really have to go out there and get fracking because, really a very, very threatening situation for me. My country and for the whole world.
Maria, I'm sorry. It sounds like you're cutting out a bit. I don't know if it's your line or ours, but we're going to hang up and we're going to call you right back. And hopefully we can get a better line. Sorry about that. Josh, can you just give us a quick overview while we reconnect with Maria about what's happening in Romania?
Well, I'm really not the expert in Romania, but it's clear that that it's very similar to the situation that's happened all across Europe. I mean, there are many things that you can start to do when confronted with this issue. What I do know is that very recently there was a protest of about 400 people in Romania that had blockaded and surrounded, I believe, Chevron as they were attempting to move in. And some of those protesters were actually coming on horse-drawn carts. I found that image incredibly inspiring. That here's a group of people. Now in Romania, I also know they don't own their mineral rights. So in the United States, a lot of people, landowners are persuaded to lease their land by hefty offers from the natural gas or oil industry to lease their mineral rights so that they get a percentage of what's drilled. What I heard from Romanian activists was because all the mineral rights are owned by the state, farmers don't have anything to gain, people don't have anything to gain, but that the gas industry was going around and offering food and meats and other things door to door to try to persuade people. Clearly that effort hasn't been effective. I mean, I think what I found out is when making that film, Gasland, was that there was a rampant problem everywhere the industry was going of these same problems: water contamination, air pollution, destruction of communities. And then looking, 5 years later at all the science that has come out about this, from climate change to water contamination to air pollution, that what the citizens were reporting on the ground to me in that first film has been borne out by the scientific and peer-reviewed evidence. That film struck a chord with people. And if you have, farmers in Romania obviously know the value of their water, know the value of their environment. And when I heard about this protest that was several weeks ago with the horse-drawn carts, I was just so moved by that. And I'd love to hear more from Maria about the effect that that's had on this on the government there.
Yeah, and according to Think Progress, the government's decision to open the country to fracking has sparked many protests, as you said, and demonstrators are calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Victor Ponta, whose center-left coalition opposed fracking pre-election, but he has since changed course. And Maria, hopefully we have a better line. Are you there?
I hope so too, yeah.
Okay.
I hope better this time. Can you hear me?
Yes, it sounds much better. So again, you heard about fracking, you saw Gasland, and you're now working, spending a lot of your time to try to raise awareness about fracking and to ban it in Romania.
Exactly, yeah. And I'm doing this without receiving any money. You know, I just decided to drop my whole life and dedicate it to this fight. It's just something that's very common. I just feel I have to do it. So, for the time being, since you had me just to, in my high road in life.
And so what are you hearing from other activists? And what would you say is most effective?
What is the most effective in general? Well, I don't know, because in Europe, across the whole Europe, we saw that the protests have really had an impact on the decision of the government. But what we can see right now in Romania is just massive protests. And the government with the most pro-fracking attitude, the whole Europe. So I wouldn't say that the success stories from the Europe would apply to Romania. Yeah, we are doing obviously same things or even more than they are doing in other countries. And our government is really, really best. So we have right now no conversation, no discussion with our government, because it doesn't want to come down to the people and talk to them and really have a conversation. They are just trying to impose the truth the lobbyists are preparing for them, and it's really a very, very aggressive strategy, going into the communities, threatening people, trying to buy them out. So it's really no dialogue. Right now, I think the only strategy for the Romanians to get rid of fracking would be just to overthrow the government, which actually happened 1 year ago, 1 year and a half ago. So the government was overthrown, and one of the reasons was fracking and gold mining. Now, the new government, now it's not that new anymore, it's holding to the position that they were actually accusing last year.
So the government.
Yeah, this is really a problem of democracy, of legitimacy of government now. So I think for us, the only way to go right now is protesting until this government is really resigning. Nobody expects any other situation in the way they are handling the whole fracking story.
And Josh, I know that we have to let you go in about a minute. Gosh, I mean, there's just so much to talk about, and it's hard to keep up with all the studies that have come out. But what would you say is, you know, I mean, what have you kind of looked at recently that got you excited, or what studies do you think we need to know about that have come out recently?
Well, I think the biggest point that has to be made right now is the one about climate change. I think that it's very clear. We've won the debate on fracking and water contamination. It's so clear what is happening when you drill through aquifers, that you create a conduit that is not for the oil and gas layers and for fracking chemicals that are used to enter into the water supply. What it seems like our government in the United States is doing is saying, well, we've got to get rid of coal, so we're going to transfer our new power infrastructure, power plants, and so on, to natural gas. Because the natural gas industry has come in and said, well, we burn cleaner than coal. And as you noted, that the burning of the gas is not the whole story. It's also the methane leakage. And when you see that report out of the Los Angeles Basin, which is drilling for oil and gas and fracking and the delivery systems, and that they're leaking 17% of the methane in that gas and oil field, it is really, truly astounding. That is a leakage rate that will contribute overwhelmingly to climate change. Methane is up to 105 times more potent than carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere, which means if you leak in a 20-year time frame, which means if you leak a certain percentage, between 1 and 3%, more, you're doing worse than coal.
And,
this is,
And Josh, we have to go to a break, and I know we have to let you go. So thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back to continue this discussion.
Oh, well, thank you, and I'm happy to be on. And listen, Californians really have to get together on this. This is something that should be a no-brainer for Governor Brown. We must develop renewable energy and not go ahead and frack all of California's Central Valley, where so much of the agriculture and produce for the whole nation is produced.
Josh Fox is director and producer of Gasland. Thank you so much, Josh. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is always better with more people getting involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, please call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about activism on the high seas. We'll be joined by members of Greenpeace who are in the Bay Area with their Rainbow Warrior ship. The ship's goal is to expose and combat environmental crimes and abuses on the sea through direct action. So what questions do you have about the effectiveness of ocean activism? That is tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. Today, we are talking about the global movement against fracking. Last month, activists in more than 20 countries participated in a day of action called the Global Frackdown. They say that fracking is not part of our vision for a clean energy future and should be banned. So what can we learn from them? Here in California, 20 climate scientists delivered a letter to Governor Jerry Brown this morning calling on him to impose a moratorium on fracking. At least 1,200 California oil and gas wells have been fracked in the past 3 years. According to this group of scientists, without any review, oil companies are already targeting the Monterey Shale, a formation that could hold billions of barrels of oil. Senate Bill 4, recently signed by Governor Brown, would allow fracking to continue without safeguards for California's air, water, and climate. And I also wanted to thank Maria Olteanu, who had to leave us. She's an anti-fracking activist in Romania who's now working almost full-time to ban fracking there. There was a lot of activity there in the last couple of weeks, and you can find links at yourcallradio.org. Joining us for the rest of the hour is Geert De Kock. He's policy officer for Food and Water Watch Europe. He's joining us from Belgium. He works on the campaign to ban fracking across Europe. And we have full lines, but we'll have one open in a few minutes. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Geert, which multinationals are actually doing the fracking in other parts of the world? Are they the same multinationals that are doing it here in the United States?
Yes, that would be the short answer. So it is mainly the super oil majors, Exxon, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Shell. Those are the big ones that are really pushing this in Europe. So there's some smaller players Canadian companies like Talisman. But it's mainly the U.S. Big oil companies that come in. And I have to also add that they're not doing their own lobbying. They're also being supported by a lot of the American embassies in Europe that are also really pushing this message about this great abundance of natural gas that is easy to extract from shale, supposedly, and really providing the talking points to policymakers and really amplifying the messages of Exxon and Chevron that supposedly fracking can be done safely and so on. So it's not that we're just opposing the American multinationals. We're also opposing the American government that's actively lobbying, you know, shipping people, paying trips from European policymakers to the U.S. to visit frack sites. And so we're fighting both fronts. We're fighting not only the super oil majors, but also the American, public diplomacy on this issue.
Here in the United States, the oil companies are not required to reveal the chemicals that they pump into the ground. What is it like in Europe and other countries? Are you able to get your hands on that information? Because it's really hard for us to get our hands on that information.
Well, legally, they are required to disclose the chemicals that they use in hydraulic fracturing. However, I mean, that is the law, that there's EU regulation on that front about disclosure of chemicals for specific intended uses. However, you know, the European Commission, which is sort of the European administrative body that looks at the implementation of European Union legislation, recently came out with a study and said, well, you know, actually, we don't really know what's being used for fracking. It's not very transparent. The implementation at national level, because it's always up to the member states to really implement the EU law, is really lacking, and there's a lack of transparency. The industry has provided some websites that say, well, you know, this is what we use, but the monitoring and the compliance with EU law is really questionable for the moment. So while, you know, legally speaking, the situation is quite different from the U.S., I think practically local communities don't know what's being injected near their houses or near the schools or whatever.
And I should say that in 2005, at the urging of Vice President Dick Cheney, fracking fluids were exempted from the Clean Water Act after companies that own the patents on the process raised concerns about disclosing these formulas. What about, Geert, even finding out where it's happening? Because we finally got a member of a government official from California to come on the show, but he had a hard time even telling us where it was happening, when it was happening, and who was doing it. So are you able to get that information?
No, and this is a lot of the licenses that are given to corporations are given for general oil and gas development, so they don't necessarily say this is where fracking will happen at this time. And so, for example, in Germany, I know that one of the women there who got involved in a local group opposing fracking said, we only found out when the drilling crew arrived with the rig and, you know, then when they started saying, well, you know, we're going to start fracking, and that's when people found out. This is also why we're really fighting to have a mandatory environmental impact assessment before every unconventional gas operation goes ahead. So we've convinced members of the European Parliament to vote in favor of this, but of course, industry is pushing back, and also some member states are heavily opposing this, because a mandatory environmental impact assessment for unconventional shale gas drilling would require an information to local populations that this would be happening. It would require baseline studies to be done. You know, what is the level of methane in the water? What's the local air quality? So we would be able to compare before and after fracking happens. And so this is something that we're really pushing. So people should know when fracking is coming to their backyard.
Geert de Kock is Policy Officer for Food and Water Watch Europe. He's joining us from Belgium to talk about the global campaign to ban fracking. And let's hear from Roseanne in El Cerrito. Hi, Roseanne. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. I wanted to ask the Food and Water Watch fellow if he had thoughts on, since this is global, on providing energy to the big nation users like India and China, because I know that James Hansen's made the case of wanting to pursue nuclear because that's the only way we can get the energy needs to those countries, even though he's advocated strongly for keeping the coal, gas, oil, and all of that in the ground, which I really want to do. But beyond California and the United States, and I know you've mentioned Europe, are there any thoughts for alternative needs for the big electricity users in Asia, India, China, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we found a couple articles about China and India. According to PRI, China's leaders have begun to turn toward natural gas as a, quote, clean-burning energy solution. The state-owned PetroChina recently signed its first production agreement with Shell in March. Opposition is beginning to stir in China. At least one protest was held in recent months. And then, according to a piece in the New York Times, the fracking boom has touched down in India via surging demand for a tiny bean called guar. Let's see, India grows about 85% of the world's guar, and with demand from fracking on the rise, armies of small farmers are being recruited to ensure that supply can keep up. Have you been keeping in contact with activists in India or China, Geert, about what's happening on the ground there?
Well, I mean, when you say a fracking boom is happening in India, I think that's a bit
early. This is according to the piece in the New York Times.
Yeah. I think what's happened is that these guar beans, which are being used in the frack fluids, are being sourced from India, and that so the shale gas boom is in the U.S. has led to a real demand for some agricultural products in India, which has obviously also maybe displaced some food production there. The question for me is: does shale gas offer a solution for emerging economies like China and India? I would argue no. I mean, there's none of the geological knowledge available. It will take decades to develop this. So, and they don't have decades. They must act now. And I think if you look at all the newly installed capacity, all the gigawatts that are being added in China, I think you'll see that very little of that is coming from nuclear or shale gas, but a lot of it is coming from renewables. And I think the Chinese government is also really pushing rollout of renewables in a much more aggressive way than is happening maybe in the U.S. or even in Europe. So there's really a big push for renewables to deliver that growing need for power, and that I think they also understand that if shale gas is developed, it's going to have a major impact on local water quantity, water shortages, which already exist in China. So I really don't see how shale gas can provide any of the answers there. I think going back to the message of the global frackdown, I think shale gas is not a transition fuel to a zero-carbon economy or zero-carbon power. Shale gas just is some of the same old answers. Renewables, energy efficiency, those are the real challenges that we have to take up and develop.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ruth Ann. And we have an email from Stephanie about renewables, who says, your solution is resorting to renewable energy, but are we realistically in a place today where renewable energy like solar and wind can withstand the demands of America, and I would say across the world? If not, the oil and gas industry, she writes, will simply resort to coal or other harmful methods. What's your response to that, Geert?
Well, I think a lot, for example, in Europe, which is obviously the situation that I know best, I think 40% of our gas is used for heating and cooling. So if we would just insulate our houses slightly better, we could have a huge impact on demand for natural gas. So rather than always increasing the supply side, I think we should really focus on the demand side. And this message is shared by the International Energy Agency, saying, the cheapest energy conservation strategy is to invest in conservation. And it's a dollar not spent on energy is the cheapest way of getting your carbon emissions down. So I think this is really where a lot of the answer lies, in avoiding that we always increase our need for our demand for natural gas, and really start focusing on, for example, heating of buildings, really moving away from that. And I think that's where we can get a lot of the increased demand for natural gas. We can avoid that increased demand.
All right. Well, thank you again for that email, Stephanie. And you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. We still have full lines, but we'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. Today, we're talking about the global movement against fracking. Last month, activists in more than 20 countries participated in a day of action called the Global Frackdown. And so far, they say that more than 336 measures against fracking have been passed. Just for an example, a moratorium on fracking was passed in the Delaware River Basin. Fracking has been banned in Longmont, Colorado. An indefinite moratorium on fracking in Vermont. Bans have been upheld in Bulgaria and France despite intensive push from the industry. In Romania, there was a rejection of fracking by more than 90%. There's been a ban on fracking, or a push for ban on fracking in areas for drinking water in Germany, moratorium on fracking in Netherlands and the Czech Republic. So lots of activity happening around the globe. And we're talking today about what that activism looks like, what's most effective, And how are activists talking to each other? And let's hear next from Brenda in Berkeley. Hi, Brenda. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I wanted to mention one of my favorite spin techniques. And Geert mentioned this, that you'll hear the pro-gas people constantly repeat that fracking can be done safely. It can be done safely. And that's almost beside the point, because the question is, will it be done safely? And I believe it's not cost-effective to do it safely. The evidence is that in order to make a return on their investment, they can't invest in safety. And I think that we should puncture holes in that kind of spin.
All right.
We can all tell people that when you hear these debates, if you hear someone say it can be done safely, you should question whether it will be done safely.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Brenda. We'll get a response after a few more callers. Let's go to Barbara in Marin County. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. I want to thank you so much for the show. One of the most important points I think that I haven't heard enough said is the danger of earthquakes. I mean, we know that from Josh's wonderful films that in Arkansas, Ohio, any number of states have witnessed a huge surge in earthquakes, and particularly for California, we have such a delicate situation going on and so rampant to have, you know, Chevron and Big Oil use their influence again and again and again, you know, to which amounts to imperiling the rest of the state and the country for their reliance on the agricultural produce that this state provides for this country and lots of the world. To have, you know, this kind of thing going on, where are the scientists on geology? Where are the scientists to say this is, you know, falls in the face of, you know, being mindful of the public's, you know, we have the doctrine of public trust. The elected officials are supposed to defend, you know, protect the public, you know, and where's the principle of precaution involved? You know, where is this? I mean, how can people be willing to buy in on, you know, the confusion that the big oil is providing to everyone, that it's not so bad, it uses less water than coal, it's okay, and
well,
it's not okay.
Well, thank you for calling. And again, this morning, 20 climate scientists delivered a letter to California Governor Jerry Brown calling on him to impose a moratorium on fracking in California. And you can find that letter along with information about a recent study in the Journal of Geophysical Research at yourcallradio.org. It found that the methane leak rate from L.A. area oil and gas operations was 17%. Because methane is a powerful pollutant, leakage rates of more than 3% make these fuels worse for the climate than coal. And according to these scientists, at least 1,200 California oil and gas wells have been fracked in the past 3 years without any scientific review. And oil companies are looking at Monterey Shale. So thank you for that. And then to your point about earthquakes, Grist has a piece about fracking triggering more than 100 earthquakes in Ohio. Mother Jones has a piece about earthquakes in across the country. And then Natural News has a piece about earthquakes in Texas as a result of fracking. So thank you for calling about that. And we'll probably do another show specifically on California, but today we're talking about what's happening around the globe. Let's take another call, and then we'll go to an activist in Argentina to talk about this. Let's hear from Ray in Santa Cruz. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Rose. Hey, thanks for another great show. And I just want to put one little thing out there, that alternatives are very real, and there are a lot of them. It's not just about wind and solar. Biofuels are very viable, and they can be done very sustainably. You don't have to take cropland out of production for food. They can be made from algae, which is, I'm a biodiesel guy myself, and that's real. Some of the stuff that we get is actually produced from algae, and I have a really good friend who has done massive research on alcohol for about 35 years now, and it can be made from things like kelp grown in shallow beds off the coast. It's a highly sucrose rich and very fermentable. And
well, you know, thank you for calling. And I'm sorry to cut you off. It's just that we're almost out of time and I really want to get to our other activists. But I promise we did a show about ocean acidification earlier this week and renewables came up. And I think we really need to do a show specifically about renewable energy. And so thank you for calling, Ray. And now let's go to Diego DiRiccio. He is with Observatorio Petrolero Sur in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Hi, Diego. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for calling and sharing these activities.
Well, thank you so much. So I just wanted to read a piece from the Earth Island Institute about what's happening in Argentina. According to this piece, Argentina imports more than $10 billion of gas and oil every year, a number that amounts to the country's entire trade deficit. The government thinks it has found a solution. One of the largest shale oil and shale gas reserves in the world sits beneath the Argentine Andes. So can you give us a quick overview, Diego? Is fracking happening in Argentina? And just give us an update of this. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's in its initial states. From 2009, exploration started, the first exploration stages, and in 2011, we had the first well fracked in an indigenous community in the center of Neuquén province. This is the north of Patagonia. From that moment on, and especially after some releases from the U.S. Government and other activities from the Argentinian government, Argentina's national state, and in 2011, as you said, was the first year that Argentina lost self-sufficiency in, especially in gas. And both the government and corporations have started a race to start to understand how this Vaca Muerta formation, this shale formation, behaves, how much oil and gas could be extracted. And so at this moment, we have big major companies like Shell, Total, BP, Petrobras, Chevron, Exxon, and some miner like Apache exploring and developing the shale formations, especially in north of Patagonia. We have more than 300 wells until this moment, more or less. There's no accurate data, so we are just guessing in many aspects about how shale and other unconventional oil and gas formations are being developed. But also what we are seeing is a very strong campaign from this community of interest. By this I mean the state, national and provincial, and also from companies, national and transnational companies, to valorize these resources and to finally export out of the country towards the centers of consumption, the north, maybe to the new centers.
Diego, did I hear you right? Is fracking happening in Patagonia?
Yeah, it's happening especially in the north of Patagonia. Wow. and in the center in some wells for exploration.
How are activists on the ground responding to this?
For example, we had this last year, the whole movement has been under two strategies. On the one hand, we had local bans in municipalities, and on a national level, we are having almost 30 bans that were made by the movement of people, by organizing themselves, by informing their neighbors and their different kind of unions and activists from different sites, and they got this we got this important step forward that was like in a very symbolic victory. And on the other hand, for example, there is the movement that is developing more in the north of Patagonia, where mostly these wells are being done and Vaca Muerta formation is being explored and developed. It's the information and getting to know how fracking really impacts. I mean, we are talking about... Yeah, sorry.
That is Diego DiRiccio with Observatorio Petrolero Sur. He's joining us from Buenos Aires, Argentina. And now I would like to welcome Tisha Brown to the show. Tisha is with Frack Off London and No Dash for Gas. They've been coordinating protest camps. Hi, Tisha. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. And thanks so much for waiting patiently. We just got slammed with phone calls today. In our remaining minutes, can you talk about just how you're all working together, since this is a global movement. And when you drill down, I mean, you've got the same multinationals working in California as you do in London and Argentina. So are you all talking to each other?
Yeah, no, using various either activist networks or social media like Facebook, like Twitter, we're definitely getting in contact with activists around the world. Specifically, we've had a lot of contact with activists in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Australia, just trying to figure out strategies as how best to fight this. And we found the best strategy seems to come from Australia, where they've kicked out two companies that were fracking.
Hmm.
And it was really getting communities, they called it Lock the Gate strategy, and it's kind of like a neighborhood watch, but for the industry. And so people set up a phone tree, and when the industry is trying to come in to frack in that area, they set up blockades and they just refuse to let them there.
Hmm.
And they do surveys throughout the community to say how many people are for fracking, and it just shows or against fracking, and they've gotten up to like 90% of people against it, and they'll declare their community frack free.
Wow. So they
what it really shows. Oh, sorry.
So they physically just stop the multinationals from coming in.
Exactly, exactly. And what it shows is that there's absolutely no social license for the industry there. And when you have, you know, rolling blockades happening within not just one neighborhood, and we're talking about entire, like, counties that are frack-free and refuse to let the companies in, they realize, actually, it's not worth their time to pay for the security, to have to deal with protesters. They decide, you know what, we're just going to back out of this area. And it's worked for two companies. We're really hoping to replicate that strategy here in the UK and see if we can do the same thing.
And in 30 seconds, Tisha, what message would you send to activists here in California?
Definitely work together with even people you wouldn't necessarily assume that are activists. We're working with unions, we're working with pensioner groups, we're working, you know, with moms and dads. Like, this is an issue that affects everyone. And so I think being as open as possible and spreading information to everyone is really very important.
Tisha Brown is with Frack Off London and No Dash for Gas. They've been coordinating protest camps, and she's been communicating with activists around the globe, but specifically in Algeria and Germany, to talk about tactics. Diego de Resirio is an activist in Buenos Aires, Argentina. We'll put a link to articles about fracking in Patagonia. And Geert de Kock is policy officer for Food and Water Watch Europe. He's been joining us from Belgium to talk about campaigns to ban fracking across Europe. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you. And thank you for listening. You can find the letter that climate scientists sent to Governor Jerry Brown this morning, calling on him to impose a moratorium on fracking here in California, at our website, yourcallradio.org. How is Greenpeace's Rainbow Warrior changing the game when it comes to civil disobedience on the high seas? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about activism in the ocean. The ship's goal is to expose and combat environmental crimes on the sea through direct action. Greenpeace calls the Rainbow Warrior an icon of nonviolent direct action and a beacon of hope. What questions do you have about the effectiveness of ocean activism? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.